Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're kicking off our end-of-year fundraising drive with a special discount offer from our partner, Heritage Foods USA, an online farm-to-table butcher shop specializing in heritage-breed antibiotic-free meats. Donate to Heritage Radio Network before Sunday, December 4th at heritageradionetwork.org/donate, and we'll send you an exclusive discount code for 10% off all Heritage Foods products. Help ensure another year of great food radio, get 10% off delicious and sustainably produced meat, and support small family farms all in one shot. How's that for a holiday miracle? Head to heritageradionetwork.org/donate by Sunday, December 4th to make your contribution.
If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with a New York State Certified seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to episode 10 of Why Food. We've been gone for 2 weeks, but we're back on air. I'm your host, Patrick McAndrew. And this week I'm here with Brian Smith and Jackie Cascuna from Ample Hills. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining us here today. Very excited. I've been a huge fan since I landed because I mentioned to Brian I used to work in Gotham West Market at Genuine Roadside at one stage. And God, it was just so close and easy. It was great just to pop up and see all the different flavors every day that were churning in and out.
Nice.
How recently did you open up that location?
That location was opened up 2 years ago, I would say, right?
Yeah. And that was the first one outside of Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, yeah, that was our first outside.
So your first opening was in 2011
mm-hmm.
in Prospect Heights.
Yep.
Yes, that's right.
And that went down a storm.
What's that?
That went down a storm. That went a lot better than you expected, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it did. A little too well at first because we ran out of all the ice cream at the beginning and had to shut the door. So it was not a fun beginning.
Yeah, we weren't prepared for such success so quickly. We were prepared to, you know, not be successful and close down, but not.
Yeah. Not we sort of successful. Emotionally prepared for, you know, what it would mean to move back in with mom and dad kind of thing.
Really?
But we hadn't really thought through what happens if people beat down the doors for the ice cream. And, you know, by day two, we could see that we were selling ice cream faster than we were making it. And by day three, we were starting to run out of flavors. And by Saturday of Memorial Day weekend, 75 degrees out, we had to shut the doors because we'd run out of everything.
And was that just through rapid word of mouth?
Yeah, yeah. And well, the New York Times had done a piece on the Wednesday that we opened, and so that didn't help or hurt. I mean, it was
it
great.
It helped.
It was wonderful, but in retrospect, it made it very challenging, yes. And so then we were closed for 9 days and doubled the staff, quickly trained a whole bunch of new people. This thing that we'd spent 6 months very carefully trying to do, we did all over again in 9 days and reopened the doors. Managed to stay open ever since. But
so that probably just set the grounding as to where you were going to start from there on. You just knew it was going to be constant business, churning out ice cream all
the
time.
That summer was crazy. I think, I don't know, I saw you maybe out of the kitchen for like 5 hours a week.
Yeah, those were the times of 14-hour days and you know, I lost 25 pounds the first summer that I owned an ice cream shop because I'd never done a day's worth of manual labor before in my life.
A lot of elbow grease, I'm sure.
Carrying 50-pound bags of sugar up and down the steps on my feet all day making ice cream. It was a rough summer, but I knew I had one summer in me like that, but probably not many more than that.
So that's 2011. We're now in 2016. Yeah. Is there 7 locations? Is that where you're at right now?
We have 6 locations in New York, and then we have a shop in Disney.
Right. It's pretty amazing. It's an amazing leap. And now you're looking to open up a factory in Red Hook as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's right, yeah.
So when's that on the cards to be opened?
Well, when do we want it to open and when will it actually open? I'd say March.
Yeah, April, May.
We're
working on it. It's going to be a beautiful 15,000 square foot facility with a retail shop and an opportunity for people to take classes within the factory floor and see the factory floor, take self-guided tours, field trips for schools, ice cream, birthday parties. So we're really trying to make it an interactive destination that people can actually see where all that ice cream is being made. And it will allow us to make enough ice cream to sort of take us through the next 5 to 10 years of our growth.
You must be so looking forward to it, because whenever I go to one of your locations, it's very immersive. I said this to you, Brian, it's like going into a playground, you know, mm-hmm. once you go inside those doors. So I suppose you're going to have the opportunity to build an extremely big playground where you can welcome a lot more people.
Yeah, that's the fun part. It's great. I mean, that's one of the things I think we love doing most of all, is building really cool, fun, interactive shops.
Yeah,
and it was thanks to a huge equity investment, right, that you had the opportunity to do this.
Yes, we did. We did after we made the relationship with Disney. That sort of led to a need to start to expand and grow, and so we found some investors. We've got a wonderful group of investors. We did an equity raise maybe about a year ago now. To support the build-out of the factory. And then once that comes online, we'll be able to start to open more shops and be able to push pints out into the marketplace in a little more concerted way. Yeah.
And was that investment the catalyst that allowed you to move away from teaching, that allowed you to,
yeah,
to say,
actually,
you know, let's,
yes,
let's give Ample Hills... You know, because I'm sure it must have been so hard to juggle teaching and your children,
yeah,
and then Ample Hills on top of all of that. So
yeah.
Very lucky to, or you must be so proud now that you have an opportunity to put all your efforts behind Ample Hills.
Totally. Yeah, it was really difficult for 3 years trying to juggle coming back from teaching to the shop, trying to deal with all the logistics of running a shop and a retail business, having two little kids. So now at least there's one less thing on our plate, or on my plate right now. So it was a big, I have to give a big shout out to the investors, because really they're just so supportive too. So it's wonderful. I've heard not so great stories sometimes from people who get outside, help, and ours was definitely one of a positive nature. So,
And with the nature of the show, I want to tie it back to your past, because both of you were teachers. That's where you both started out.
Yeah.
Before you moved on to a colorful career within,
yes,
as a screenwriter and director, yeah, and producer.
Yes, that's true. I was a teacher. I only put in about 2 or 3 years teaching, while Jackie did 18, 19?
Yeah.
A lot of years.
But that's where we met. We met teaching.
Yes, we did. We met teaching, so it gave us that. And that was a really good thing. And a lot of employees.
Of employees. A lot of our employees were former students.
Oh, really?
Of mine. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's brought its rewards.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Plenty
of
them. And then after, so you continued teaching, and you taught in the same school you went to high school, I believe.
I did.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah. I miss it. I love it.
Do you?
It was a hard decision to make, honestly.
But you're lucky to go from one industry where there's great camaraderie to go into another, because I suppose that's the great thing about the hospitality industry, that it's always a team effort. You're always in it together. It's,
yep,
never a one-man show.
Totally.
So to have left that behind for, you know, something that would maybe be an individual piece would be a lot more difficult.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's great to be able to make people happy with ice cream, so there's really nothing to complain about in terms of, like, the service that we're offering. So I love that part of it.
And then, Brian, you had moved from teaching to be a screenwriter and a producer.
Yeah, so I actually did quite a bit of radio and worked at... producing and directing audio dramas, radio plays, both for books on tape and CD and streaming audio during the first dot-com boom, long before you could do, you know, this was dial-up modem, streaming audio, radio plays before podcasts. And so I did that and for public radio as well, and then moved into screenwriting and wrote some pretty bad TV movies, Monster of the Week kind of things, Sci-Fi Channel, Giant Killer Birds, those kind of things, and was getting tired of trying to get that next gig and the next gig, and it wasn't really materializing into stepping up to, you know, Steven Spielberg kind of range of selling a script. It was staying down there. And, you know, we were sort of slowly eating away at our life savings, or I was, because, you know, she couldn't support both of us with her teaching salary. And so, you know, that sort of was slowly ebbing away. And it was there was only a finite amount of time. And so that was sort of the real catalyst to say, you know, to get up off the couch and say, okay, we can either just, this money will just whittle away eventually, or we could use it to invest in something and create something. And the ice cream had always been there in the back of my head, and it had always just been a fantasy. But that really crystallized it. Ultimately, if I'd have had more success, you know, selling scripts, or, you know, that had moved a little faster, a little quicker along the way, you know, we probably wouldn't have had Ample Hills. You know, that might have been something to do in our 60s, you know.
And when you say it was it always there as making ice cream as a passion, or going to ice cream parlors and thinking, I want to own one of these one day?
I think for me, it was the making ice cream. I mean, I used to make ice cream a lot when we would go into the Adirondacks, where Jackie's family would go to in the summertime. And so once I joined the family, would go up there and would make ice cream and hand-cranked ice cream makers for people. So it was sort of, had always been part of what I wanted to do, but I didn't really have any thought of how to turn that sort of passion for making ice cream into an actual business. And ultimately, Jackie's work at teaching and working with people, that influenced greatly the sort of what I call like the front of house of Ample Hills, the sort of the customer service, the community spot, the gathering spot, the feeling of the front of the house for the user experience comes mostly through Jackie and her work. And then most of the ice cream side of things, the concocting flavors, is coming through my part. So if it had just been me, it would certainly not have
the experience. It's always necessary to be in the yin and the yang. And it's amazing to see it so often, especially when couples go into opening a restaurant or in anything within hospitality. There is always that person that has the front of house knowledge, and then it's indelible that the person has the back of house knowledge to understand.
Yeah, I don't think either of us had any knowledge, but
we didn't have knowledge, but we had, but your life experience,
our desires were definitely you know, his was to make the best ice cream, and mine was to make the best ice cream shop that people wanted to spend time in and be in and be a part of, and have it be a place in a community that could, you know, not just be a place where you're going to grab an ice cream cone and run out, but a place where you can spend time and bring your family, your children, or your date, or, you know, your grandmother. And so that was, I think, one of the most important parts about opening our first shop, and really about opening every other shop after that for me.
Well, before we get into talking about the opening days of Ample Hills, we're going to go to a quick break.
New York chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
All right, welcome back to episode 10. I'm here with Brian Smith and Jackie Cascuna from Ample Hills, and we're going to get into it. So, Ample Hills opened up 2011. Brian had been in the background making ice cream. He brought this passion to the store. Jackie wanted to create an amazing ice cream parlor, one of the best around. You created it, this beautiful, color, vibrant playground. Mm-hmm. And where did it go from there? You just started churning out. How many flavors did you start off with?
24. Started out with 24 flavors. That was probably a little crazy. I mean, all the decisions we made, we didn't necessarily make with a lot of background knowledge about what how difficult it would be. I mean, we also made all of our ice cream from scratch, from beginning to middle to end, from the beginning, which meant we had a pasteurizer, which meant we were combining milk and cream and eggs and all the ingredients to cook the ice cream, whereas most mom-and-pop ice cream shops will buy what's called a bag mix or a dairy mix from a dairy farm.
And what was your reason to decide to want to do
that? For me personally, it never occurred to me to do anything different on a basic stupid level. It didn't even occur to me. But then when it did occur to me, when I was told, oh boy, that's dumb, you should not do it that way, it seemed like cheating. It didn't seem like I was really making ice cream if I was assembling ice cream. If I took a bag mix that was already ice cream and then I added some peanut butter to it or some, eggnog flavoring to it, it wasn't really making ice cream. And coming from a creative background, I knew I wanted to create this thing. I mean, I wanted to make it. And also then, in retrospect, what it did allow us to do, although I'm not sure this was so conscious, is it allows us to be really nimble with the kind of flavors we make. And so we're able to adapt and change. We're able to make pretzel-infused ice creams, popcorn-infused ice cream. We're able to make all those different things because we're adjusting the basic recipes and pasteurizing our own base and really taking it from the ground up. And I think that was a lot of the DNA that I think attracted people to it, because they could come into the shop and they could see us doing it and actually making it and then making all that stuff that goes into the ice cream, all the cookies and cake pieces.
Yeah, that's another thing, because it's one thing wanting to pasteurize all your own milk, but it's another thing wanting to bake everything when it's readily available there for you.
Yeah.
At the beginning, when you had to close down after 4 days, did it cross your mind and think, we have to start from scratch and make all this stuff again when we could just go out and buy it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Of course it did. Yes. But I felt like, well, we've gone down this road. We've made these decisions, and they got people to come and stand in line those first 4 days. We just didn't feel like, we really had a choice. I mean, we didn't really want to make that choice. But, even now, over the last 5 or 6 years, there have been many opportunities to take out into the world of co-packers, which is what most people would do, and go have our brownies made elsewhere or our ooey gooey cake made elsewhere. But it's just, again, I don't think that somebody else can make it as well as we can, and I don't think that they can make as many variations as we can. And it's just part of who we are, and we now need to figure out how to scale two businesses, an ice cream making business and a bakery business, because basically they're wholly and completely different businesses now. The nice thing about the bakery is we don't have to worry about how anything looks. That's the really nice thing about baking mix-ins for ice cream, because they all get chopped up into little pieces and put into the ice cream. So while, baking schools are a lot about presentation and how that, looks and how it's cut,
you
don't have to worry
about
all that. So that's a really good thing.
As much as the ice cream is incredible, and I love it, it's delicious, your packaging is top-notch. It's fun, it's playful, the names are great. When you started off, it's none of it is just basic names. You haven't just slapped a basic name or tried to create some pretentious fancy infused flavor that really should be on a plate in a restaurant.
Right.
Why did you decide to do that? I'm sure it was because you wanted to keep it playful all the time.
Yeah.
It was a great place to start from.
Yeah, no, we did. We wanted to keep it playful from the beginning. Ultimately, I think our ice cream tells stories. We like to tell stories. It's part of who we are as a company. And through these names, we could get really creative. And that's another part, I think, that is really important to us, is just having fun, being playful, and telling a story through a flavor and a name and what goes into it, and and connecting, I think, the person eating it with some type of memory or experience from their childhood or some type of interesting moment in time. And I think part of it's from the packaging and from the naming of the flavor and the ingredients.
That's another great thing, because the artisanal world has tried to create ice cream, which is historically a childhood favorite, and tried to bring it forward 20 generations and say, here, as adults, this is now a much more classy ice cream here for you. Yep. Whereas you guys have broken away from that artisanal mold and said, actually, here you go, guys, you're adults. Let's bring you back. Let's bring you back a few decades. Let's bring you back to your childhood.
Yeah, we often talk about the ice cream as a time machine. You know, the goal, while we make ice cream for kids, what we're really sort of thinking is we're making ice cream for kids inside of adults, which is a little different in terms of just how we think about it, because ultimately much of the artisanal ice cream and food movement is aimed at adults, and we really are more interested in and taking people back to the childhood, even if in their childhood they never had an ice cream quite like the one that we're making. There's something about it that's resonating and pulling them back. And if we can make those connections with people, they have a stronger loyalty, I think, to the brand as we grow and as we think about how to position ourselves among all the other ice cream players out there.
So one thing that I mentioned, and this is probably a personal thing, I'm doing this for myself because I want to know how to do it. So I have no equipment at home to make ice cream, but I want to make ice cream. Where do I start off and how do I go about it?
Well, the first thing is you definitely need to buy a piece of equipment.
Okay. So you wouldn't say churn it out by hand?
Well, yeah, I don't. I mean, you need to churn it in some way. So, I mean, ice cream as a food has to be frozen while churning. The reason for that, very simply, is if you take milk and cream and sugar and eggs, the best milk and cream and sugar and eggs you can find, you mix them together, you add a bunch of flavorings, and you stick them in the freezer, and you come back tomorrow to eat it, what do you have? You have a brick.
A nice little brick, yeah.
Yeah, you have a brick. And you have a very icy brick. So when you bite into it, if you ever had a fudgesicle is frozen that way. You bite into it, there's striations of ice through there. That's because it's been quiescently frozen, is a new word for the day. Quiescently. Which means that it's been...
That's a gorgeous word. Say that again, Brian.
Quiescently.
Oh, amazing.
So that word means that it's been frozen quietly. It's been frozen without agitation or churning, right?
I'm going to dream about that word tonight.
Quiescent.
Quiescently.
So it's not every day you get to learn a new word. So come on. Now, in any event... But ice cream, our traditional ice cream, has to be churned while being frozen. The reason for that is that you are incorporating a very secret ingredient into the ice cream. What is it, Patrick? What's the secret ingredient that you're adding by churning?
Air?
Air, exactly.
Yes. Oh, someone give me a gold star.
Yes. So by whipping the ice cream while churning it, you're giving it its floofy, poofy, cloud-like texture that you give to ice cream, okay?
So super eloquent.
If you just try to take a fork and do that, you're not going to quite get there. So, yeah, there's a lot of cheap ice cream makers out there, but basically an ice cream maker is simply a way to freeze your product while spinning it. And so once you do that, then that's really the only thing you need. Then you need milk, cream, sugar, and eggs to make really flavorful ice cream at home and playful ice cream at home. I recommend walking down the candy aisle at the grocery store or the cereal aisle down the grocery store. That's where we get a lot of inspiration. And, you throw in the cereal into the ice cream. You pick Kit Kats or Tootsie Rolls, or you pick out things that you go down the cookie aisle or the cookie aisle. Or, you bake them. You've got a favorite devil's food cake that you like to make at home. You just chop that up and mush that into some fresh ice cream that you make at home. I mean, that's how most of our recipes came about, honestly. Was just a lot of experimenting with baked goods that we had that we liked. And ice cream is like soup. You can really do anything with it. You can sort of throw just about anything into it.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Right. Good stuff.
But you need an ice cream maker.
Okay. So I won't use my forearm. Okay. Another thing I wanted to talk about is frozen custard got a huge amount of exposure when Shake Shack came along, because Danny Meyer was talking about he wanted to go back to frozen custard because that's what he rated as the number one. Now, on your pints, it says frozen custard, but I know on your website you said it's just down to the FDA regulations, right? So does that mean that it is or it isn't frozen custard? Do you rate it as ice cream or not?
Yes. It is ice cream, in effect. I mean, in terms of anybody's opinion or experience of it, it's ice cream. Frozen custard is a technical... FDA regulates the use of the words ice cream and the use of the words frozen custard and the use of the word sorbet. Yeah. So they do that because of the egg content, the amount of... We use egg yolks in our ice cream as an emulsifier. A lot of ice cream has egg yolks in it. But if your ice cream has more than 1.4% by volume egg yolks in it, then it raises to the level of being called frozen custard. Now, you can colloquially, that's not a word. You can call it ice cream if you want to, and we can call it an ice cream shop. But once you package it and sell it in a store in a pint container, you have to label it as frozen custard. So our ice cream is around 1.6% by volume. It's just a small bit, but we really didn't want to adjust our formulas simply to call it ice cream. It seemed like a silly thing. So Danny Meyer's frozen custard is the same thing. It's just simply served in a softer, warmer state, meaning they're serving it out of a cabinet that's warmer than our cabinet. And that's why it's soft.
It's like soft.
It's not because the actual formula is very much different. It's simply served softer.
Ah, okay. Good to know. Thank you, Brian. Yeah. So where are we going from now on with the Ample Hill's trajectory? Where do you guys look as... Now that I suppose you have the factory on the horizon, it's something that is somewhat tangible that's going to come around, and you want to open up more locations. Are there more products that you're looking to roll out or that you're looking to diversify in? I'm sure your mind is constantly running in terms of flavors.
Yeah. Flavors are endless and fun. I think really our goal is to open more shops once we're able to open the factory and to go a little bit farther, maybe out of New York, and open up some shops in a couple of other cities. And those cities will have specific flavors that we'll create, or those shops will have specific flavors that we'll create just for them, like our shops do in New York. I think that's...
Yeah, and we'll also be doing pints out into the marketplace.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that we're really working towards, how to extend pints out into the marketplace without diluting the brand, you know, which is a tough thing, because if the brand is about the experiential component of being in the shops, how can you communicate that and, you know, on a package? And so we're trying to really think about how we can do that in creative ways.
Yeah, and I think the idea also is just that our shops, you know, we want to be parts of a community, so therefore they should reflect the community that they're in, and I think being careful with where we open, but also how we create that shop that makes sense for that place is an important aspect too. And then that way, you know, when we do have pints in there in that area or that part of town, people will be able to, you know, go to the shop and understand where the ice cream is coming from.
And when you say that as well, do you mean in terms of the layout of the shop that you try to put the design in reflection of the place that it's in, or it's just in terms of the ice cream?
Yeah, definitely the design of the... And it should reflect that space, that place, but also the ice cream flavors. Each one of our shops in New York have a specific flavor that either pays tribute to the neighborhood or a person specific to the neighborhood. Our Gowanus shop has a flavor called It Came From Gowanus, which is a tribute to Brian's sci-fi writer life, previous life.
The Gotham West Market one that you talked about, that's Hell's Kitchen Sink, because
my
that
favorite
neighborhood is...
that's got Guinness in it, right?
Yeah, yes. A lot of Guinness.
Because the neighborhood is historically an Irish neighborhood, and so that's why the Guinness is in there, to sort of represent that part of the past. So, we like to do that.
It's an intense flavor.
It is,
and
yeah.
So, you know, if we have a shop in Kentucky or Ohio or wherever it may go from here, those shops would make a flavor on site that would... you know, in microcosm, tell the story of how we make ice cream back at the factory. So we can sort of benefit from the economies of scale of having the factory, but also have this thing that localizes whatever what's otherwise a growing, you know, chain, an anti-chain chain, but, a multiple shops.
You touch in with the locality every time you make something, which makes it so great.
Yeah.
And one thing that I'm going to finish with today, you can answer this together, you can answer it separately, is what has food given you? I'm going to correct that. What has ice cream given you since you opened up your first store, which you didn't have beforehand?
Well, I'd say most simply, ice cream gave me a job because at the very basic level, I feel like, you know, we took our life savings and went and bought myself a job. I mean, that was the base bottom low hanging fruit of Ample Hills from the beginning, because I figured if we opened up the shop, you know, at a minimum, I could be that, you know, minimum wage employee and work out of the shop. So ice cream has given me a job and now a lot more.
Yeah. I mean, ice cream's given you a job. That's been great.
What?
And no, I'm saying that's...
So because you were tired of me not having
jobs?
Is that what you're saying?
A little bit. Uh-huh. But no, I mean, I think it's also, I mean, it's offered, it's given us a lot.
Of course.
Just so. As a family, as a community, as, you know, I love hearing whenever I meet people who've been to a shop and they find out that, you know, I own the Ample Hills. They're like, wow, that I love it, and it's great. And I go there with my kids, and I went there on my first date. So it gives me great pleasure to have been able to be a part of people's everyday lives in some small way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're doing it very well. You're building a wonderful community in your hands, Jackie, and you're creating wonderful ice cream, Brian. So thanks very much for joining us today on My Food.
Thank you.
I'm super looking forward to... visiting the Red Hook factory. Really looking forward to when I get down.
Me too.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
I also want to thank the wonderful people at Heritage Radio Network for giving the industry an incredible platform to communicate and engage. Without the network, a community over 1 million listeners a month would not have access to such a broad array of topics. Please support the network by visiting heritageradionetwork.org and clicking on the heart in the top right-hand corner of the screen to donate. I want to say thanks to our wonderful producer, David Tadashore, for creating today's show. And if you want to get in touch, please do so by emailing whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. Next week, I'm going to be chatting with Jonathan Mendez, a lawyer turned restaurant owner who's bringing high quality casual Greek food to the streets of Boston. If you've enjoyed today's show and you want to listen to more, you can find them on iTunes and Stitcher. As always, please subscribe, rate and review. Thanks very much for tuning in, guys.
For listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.